Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
Listen to what I'm saying. That's right. Bring that camera in here a little bit closer.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the stud is here.
Hey, everybody. Welcome in. Let's get it underway. It's David Summers, and here comes another Studcast with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. This is the story of wrestling in America as told by the stud, whose family started the profession over 100 years ago. So now, let's step back into the ring. Back into time as we get wall-to-wall and tree-top tall with the Tennessee stud, Ron Fuller, in the Great Smoky Mountains of Tennessee. Hey, Ron, I just asked you a few moments ago if you guys had a bunch of rain. I saw on YouTube and a couple of other sources, a tremendous amount of rain was flowing through Dollywood, one of the Southeast's favorite amusement parks. How far are you from Dollywood?
About 8 miles. And I didn't get any of that.
I
saw that too, and I was like freaked out. I said, "What? How did they get that storm?" And we didn't get it. So,
man,
when
I saw it, I was like, "Man, I bet Ron's getting a bunch of rain up there too."
Yeah, I mean, it's rained some, but I think they just got a cloud burst right over Dollywood. It looked like to me, because I don't think anybody else got it in this area.
Yeah, we've been there a couple of times, a few times, I think, but I was like, wow, I can't believe this is Dollywood, and a good portion of it was starting to be underwater. Hey, listen, I want to begin today with a question, because your Studcast, dude, I called you dude, they are on fire, like your Southeastern Gulf Coast territory in July of 1980. So in the last episode, every building there sold out. While in the other Southeastern territory, where you had sold out 9 months earlier, they were really struggling just to stay alive. So why do you think you were doing so well in Alabama and the territory that you sold to the folks in Tennessee was not doing very well at all?
Well, you're jumping right on it today, Dave, you know, but I don't mind. That's a really good question. You know, I don't think that the Alabama and Tennessee fans were any different when it came to wrestling, basically. I think it had more to do with the wrestling ownerships in those two states. And then those, we're breaking attendance records in the southern part of Alabama during this time frame, while the two companies up there in the eastern side of Tennessee were failing miserable. I'm talking about, Nick Gulas's Mid-America territory in Chattanooga. Which was a great little territory, but it was starting to really suffer during this time frame. And, a lot of that, I think, had to do with Roy's passing. He passed in 1977. We're talking about 1980 now. And Nick Gulas had decimated that part of the state all the way south to Birmingham, Alabama, because they owned all the way down to Birmingham. And he really ruined his own business by putting his son, George, on top as his champion. And without a doubt, George Gulas was one of the worst wrestlers in history.
Wow.
So it was not a bright idea.
Yeah.
And some great wrestlers, going all the way back to the 1930s, including my grandfather, his three brothers, my father, and his three cousins, the Fields brothers, my brother, Jimmy Golden, and myself, we were some of the wrestlers that would have been there since the 1930s. And basically, all the Welch family members were among that group that built that territory, the Mid-American territory of Roy's and Nick Gulas's, into one of the best in the world. But for almost 50 years, it had been great. But in less than 1 year, Nick killed it by making his son, George Gulas, champion. And it's a little more difficult to explain what happened with Southeastern and Knoxville than talking about Mid-America, what happened there. These are the other Tennessee territory. Jim Barnett, Fred Ward had bought me out in 1979, and they were well-known and respected promoters. Mm-hmm. They had great wrestlers, and they were doing very good business in their own territory in Georgia. But, you know, they couldn't figure out how to once again make a huge success out of Southeastern Knoxville. So the Knoxville War that started in June of 1979 obviously had taken a toll on the territory. So within 2 months of the war starting, I could see the writing on the wall. You know, this is not going to be cured. It's never going to be the same. And Jim Barnett, he had already survived a war in Georgia from 1972 to about 1974. He had a war down there when he took over there, basically. They had been in a war for a couple of years. And I think he was overconfident, and he thought that the Knoxville War was going to be easier to win than the Georgia War was. So I think the reason it wasn't easier to win for him was the way his competition in Georgia handled their business compared to how the Knoxville Five dealt with the Southeastern War. The Georgia opposition company respected the sport. They did almost nothing, in fact, to hurt wrestling. The Georgia Five didn't care what happened to wrestling in Knoxville. And if they lost the war, they were going to try to kill wrestling there anyway. So that was their idea from the beginning. So Nick Gulas had already decided in the Mid-American territory, his day was done, and he was selling. He sold out part of the his Chattanooga area. And then he obviously sold Birmingham and all of northern Alabama to my company down there at Gulf Coast Wrestling. So he had started selling off pieces of his territory because of using George Gulas as a champion. And we were lucky. We grabbed Birmingham and the northern part of Alabama, and we're going to soon be running it and talking about it in these studcasts. So in the last studcast, I talked about their losing confidence, and that's where, and I'm talking about Barnett and Ward, they were really losing the confidence. Then they were both looking in the same direction at Nick Gulas. And, you know, they were thinking about, we talked about it a little bit in the last studcast. They were thinking about selling Knoxville. So turning around a dead and dying territory, that wasn't an easy thing to do for anybody. But with Southeastern, the Georgia promoters had definitely found that out.
Well, that's a great answer to my question, but I got to say, I thought the name Jim Barnett and Fred Ward, those two would have definitely been able to put their finger on the pulse and figure out whatever it was and make something successful out of it. But anyway, probably one of many questions that we're going to have here today. I remember you saying something last week about the Georgia promoters looking to sell, possibly. So Southeastern Knoxville and Let It Go. So, and that maybe would be a good hidden history lesson for today. So where are we riding today? Is that part of it?
Yeah, we're going to get into that sale subject today. And we're going to also take a look at the next Knoxville card on July 17, 1980. They were now on Thursday nights. It changed from Friday to Thursday nights. And at this point, they were no longer in the Knoxville Coliseum. The last studcast was the last show they ran in the Coliseum. They were moving back into Chilhowie Park Amphitheater. And it was not pretty, but it should be very interesting, this conversation about all the things that were going wrong for them. And we're also going to be returning to, obviously, the Southeastern Gulf Coast territory. We're going to be in the third week of July, same week as we're talking about them up there in Knoxville, and we got another great card there. This one again has five main events and seven total matches. And I've tried to describe the TV show promoting it, talk about the results of the matches and the attendances in the three largest cities like we normally do. And then hopefully, Dave, we may have enough maybe for a learning tree question today.
Yeah, I missed those. Let's hopefully we can get through this thing and make that happen. That would be awesome. All right. You've been packing these studcasts with so much history each week. I know it's hard to get in everything that you really want to. So are we going to begin with the hidden history lesson and find out who the Georgia promoters were considering maybe selling the southeastern Knoxville territory to? I'm curious about that.
Yeah, man, I think that's a good place to start. You know, and in this conversation, when we're talking about Georgia, you got Ole Anderson, who is the booker in that territory. And I mentioned in the last studcast about Barnett paying me the balance of what he owed me. And, I got that idea that Barnett and his partner, as soon as this went down, were looking to sell Knoxville. And I didn't even ask Ole. Ole was the one that called me and talked to me about what was going on, basically. And I didn't even ask Ole anything about it. I didn't want them to know how good we were doing in our territory, because I felt like, you know, they were already having a real problem, and that would have been really kind of punching Ole in the mouth, since he was the booker for the territory, and he couldn't get Knoxville off its butt. So I had finally began to understand why my father always said, you know, he told me, you know, as a promoter boy, he says, you never want to shine too bright a light. And shining too bright a light had a lot to do with creating the Knoxville War. Hmm. And success in wrestling, you know, he says, might bring you problems. So hide it, your success, as long as you can, basically.
Interesting. Wow.
So I started asking myself, if I was Jim Barnett and I wanted to sell, who would I think would have an interest in buying Knoxville? So obviously somebody successful and maybe wanting to expand would be the people looking for something like that. And so they would look first for something close to their territory, obviously. And it didn't take long for me to come up with somebody that was pretty obvious. The Knoxville territory butted up against one of the biggest territories in wrestling, the Mid-Atlantic territory of Jim Crockett Sr., based in Charlotte, North Carolina. And they ran everything from South Carolina north to Washington, D.C., all up the Atlantic coast. And he and his sons had the money. They had top wrestlers. They had the experience, and the experience that definitely needed to make it successful.
Okay, so were you right about that guess, Stud?
Well, I was right about it in a way, right? But in July of 1980, the deal that was going on to be made was quite a ways off. The deal, they did make a sale, but they didn't make it in 1980. Or if it was 80, it was really late 1980. So I was right about one thing, about the influence of that territory, that Mid-Atlantic territory, and about it having an effect on the sale, but not about the Crockett family itself buying it or even being interested in buying it. However, two of Crockett's best wrestlers were going to be involved in the sale of this territory to them from Jim Barnett and Fred Ward. And both of them were huge names in the sport.
All right, but so who were they?
Well, we have a long time, Dave, before this sale is going to happen. So I'd love to get to a learning tree question today, man. Maybe we jump on that next week. You know, I'm about to leave this information, I think, for the next studcast. We'll talk about these two guys. People that don't know this, the facts here are going to freak out with the two guys that end up buying that territory.
Okay, so there's no pushing the stud around. All right, so you have not done this to me in quite a while. Leave me hanging until next week. Thanks for that. All right. So how about the card for Knoxville in Chilhowee Park, the big amphitheater, and it's Thursday, July 17th, 1980. Set us up with who was on that card and what that was like.
As usual, the newspaper ad only promoted four matches, and I don't know why they didn't. If they're going to have six matches, show all six of those matches. But their ads were handled by somebody else. And So the first of those matches, the first match that they promoted on the card, was a Baron Von Raske against Tommy Rich. The next match was Kevin Sullivan and Austin Idol taking on the crazy team, man, of Abdullah the Butcher and Mark Lewin. Two off-the-wall crazy dudes there, man, that Butcher and Lewin. And then there was a World Junior Heavyweight Championship match with the very capable young star, Terry Taylor. He was a real young star. I think he was maybe Rookie of the Year in the NWA that year. Was getting a shot at the champion from United Kingdom, Les Thornton, for the World Junior Heavyweight Championship. And then there was a world, and we talk about this match in the last studcast where Ole had booked it, one of the five crazy matches between these two. There was a match in which it was mask versus mask, the assassin wrestling against Mr. Wrestling number two. So, pretty darn good card.
Wow. You mentioned Terry Taylor, a side note, and I just want to mention this real quickly. I thought he was a terrific wrestler. When he went to WWE, I thought the way they named him the Red Rooster was about as stupid and ridiculous as it could be. I didn't think he liked that persona at all. Now, maybe he did. Now, I don't know. But he didn't last there very long. And I'm wondering if it was because of the McMahon shenanigans. And I really have no idea about the situation.
That's it. That's it, Dave. Yeah. He was from the South.
Yeah.
And McMahon, he used those Southern stars, Dusty Rhodes, and he took a lot of great Southern stars.
Yeah.
And he intentionally made them look bad in his company.
Yeah, he had a bias for the Northern stars, I guess.
He had a bias for those Southern stars. He just did not like Southern wrestling because we wrestled.
Yeah.
And right. North, right. He big old monster, fat guys and big guys that couldn't wrestle, that was what he wanted to promote. So he basically had that bias against Southern wrestlers. He took great Southern stars, the Briscoes, Dusty Rhodes, Terry Taylor's a great example.
Yeah.
They were from the South. He never really gave him a shot.
The Red Rooster. I just thought, oh, my God. And I could just sort of tell he didn't seem to like it. And I could be wrong on that. But that's okay. But going back, that's four really good matches. One, a world championship. So what did you think of it, Ron?
Well, I agree. You know, Ole was basically pulling out all the stops, man. I mean, why not? He had to get this town up. So. Problem was, you know, I'd spent 5 years getting many of those old Chilhowee Park fans to come to the Coliseum at all because they had been in that building, the Chilhowee Park, forever. They'd never wrestled in the Coliseum until I bought the territory. So they felt, those old fans there that had been going for years, they felt at home in the park. So over the years, I kind of finally managed to get those park fans to come to the Coliseum. They realized they're not coming back to the park, and they said, geez, we got to go, and they've got to go. And they, once they came, they grew to love the Coliseum. They fell in love with it. So fans that wanted to see the matches in the Coliseum loved it when we moved there. And we had never, you know, had gone not gone back to the park very often, a little bit in the summer when we had to. But, you know, now they wouldn't even go there, even if for a world title match. So so I'm sure that the problem was Jim Barnett was not aware of this. He did not do his research. He didn't find out that there was another facility there other than the Coliseum. And then when he went and took killed the Coliseum and left there to take people back to the park, that was a kiss of death for him. I hate to say it, but wow. I guess that's a good way of describing it. And not only did he change the buildings, he changed his night from a Friday to a Thursday, which took him off a weekend. Now and put himself in the week during the week. So it was horrible.
Are you serious? From a Friday to a Thursday? That's crazy, but that's scary in and of itself. So you've been... You've been talking about this thing for years, building Southeastern. Obviously, you knew how it was done. So and something went wrong up there. All right, so what about the attendance that night in Chilhowie Park?
Well, even with that good a card, man, the crowd dropped from 1,500, which it was the week before, the last show in the Coliseum. It dropped down to 1,300 in the park. And then the same week, a year earlier, before I left, we drew 3,300 people in the Coliseum. I was disappointed with 3,300 in a year earlier. So
yeah.
You can see where the town is headed, man. It's a bad situation.
All right. Did you catch, I'm just curious, did you catch any flack from selling the territory? Like Ron sold us a piece of unedible fruit or anything. Did you catch anything from them like that?
No, I think they just thought that they were just going to come in there and blow things away, that, I just lost touch with how to keep the town up there and drawing big.
Yeah.
And they were going to come in, and they had all these great wrestlers. They had great talent.
Right.
And they just they had overestimated what they were going to be able to do there. And when it got bad, then they kind of started walking away from things pretty quick.
Maybe you're going to get to the point where your style was way better than their style of promoting the matches for the nights that they were going to be on, and the TV show as well. I mean, but really, that's sad for a company that had once been called the best small territory in the world. I remember you telling the stories about everybody wanted to come to your territory. All right, but before we take our break, can you give us the card for the same week? Take us down south to Southeastern Gulf Coast.
Yeah, I can definitely do that, my man. Charlie Cook opened the night against the Avenger. Plowboy Frazier wrestled Ted Oates out of Columbus, Georgia. They had two brothers there, Ted and his brother, both those boys were really good. Plowboy's taking on Ted Oates. Then the first of five main events. For the second week in a row, this is happening. This was another three-man matches. The winner is going to get to meet the champion the next week for the United States Junior Heavyweight title. In the three-man match was Tony Charles, Sweet Brown Sugar, and Ricky Gibson, all against each other, and all top wrestlers, man. All day, those guys were great. Then for the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship, Norvell Austin was wrestling the champion, Jerry Stubbs. Then a Southeastern Championship match was next. Mongolian Stomper, managed by the Big C, was wrestling the champion, Bob Armstrong, in a Texas Death Match. Then the fourth main event was for the Southeastern Tag Championship. The losing team in this one had to split forever, which meant, one of these teams is gone for good. The winning team was going to obviously be the champions. It was the Big C and Randy Rose. They were facing my brother and I. We were champions. Then in the last event, it was the match that so many of these fans in that part of the country had been waiting for, man. It was going to be the bull rope match between Joe LaDuke and Ron Bass, managed by the Big C.
Wow. Okay, that card was, if anything, better than last week's fantastic card that sold out all three of the main buildings in your territory. So, man, quite a success. So when we come back after the break, we're all going to find out who was in the next rating period TV show in the second championship match of the month. That is going to happen when we get back on this Studcast. Okay, Ron, you're out and about again. And this weekend, you're going to be in Charlotte, North Carolina. The location is the Hilton University Place, a nice convention center hotel, and the event is called The Gathering Five. So tell us what's happening and what you're going to be doing this weekend.
Yeah, I'm going to be making a little drive over there from over here in the mountains, and going to be going into Charlotte. We just mentioned Charlotte not a few minutes ago, talking about that Mid-Atlantic territory. And they had these big events over there. This is an annual one. This one, I think, is the fifth one. That's why they're calling it the Gathering Five. Like you said, it's in the Hilton University Place. Beautiful a beautiful facility, hotel and convention center built in together. And for those that may be wanting to come, it's at 8629 J.M. Keynes Drive, Charlotte, North Carolina, 28262. You can look for not just me, but old Rob's going to be with me. We're going to be at the Premier Signature booth in the show.
How often do you see Rob? And that's pretty cool that you guys are going to be hooking up for this event.
This would be the first time I've seen Rob since last Christmas.
Okay, wow. So you don't get together that often, so that this will kind of be a reunion for you guys.
Yeah, it's a great little deal for both of us, and we're going to be meeting and greeting fans, and I think we'll be signing autograph pictures for people. I'm going to take some copies of my Brutus book.
Yeah.
For fans that, the book's selling really, really good, and that people have an opportunity. I'm even going to drop the price by a third on the price of the book, and be autographing them for fans that buy the book. And we're going to be there from 10 till 2. It's going to be on Saturday, this coming Saturday, mm-hmm. August the 3rd, and from 10 till 2. And really looking forward to saying hello to a whole lot of people. I've been getting a lot of response to this signature appearance there, and looking forward to it.
All right, so Studcast fans, Ron and Robert Fuller fans, wrestling fans, put in the Gathering 5, Hilton University Place. You'll find all the information. And if you want to put it in your GPS, all the information will be right there. It's on Keynes Drive, Charlotte, North Carolina. And that's really awesome. And now, again, you guys from 10 to 2 on Saturday.
That's it.
Are you
that's
both
the only time we'll be there. For this event, it'll be for 4 hours. And if you come back between 10 and 2, you'll be able to get our autographs. And I just want to look forward to saying hello to people. We've got a lot of fans in that part of the country, and always like these meet and greets.
That's cool. Are you both going to be in the booth together?
Yep.
Oh, sure. Awesome. Awesome. So it's going to be like a meeting of the Twin Towers. How tall is Rob, by the way?
6'5".
6'5". I know, just a kid. I know. And you're 6'9". So don't push him around. I know you're going to do it anyway, or tug on his ear or something like that, because that's what older brothers do. All right. That's pretty cool. This coming Saturday, the Gathering 5 and Hilton University Place, Charlotte, North Carolina. Cool deal. All right, Studcast fans, welcome back into the second half of this Studcast. And it's been a great one so far. This is episode number 359. It's called LeDuc versus Bass, Bull Rope, and Bob Wins. We're going to get the details on all of that. All right, so as we start, Stud, you really blew me away before the break with the card that you were promoting on this TV show. So if I'm correct, it had 5 main events in 7 matches. Now, that's how you do a show. 3 championship matches. One with the losers having to split up forever as a team, a Texas death match, another great 3-man match, plus a bull rope match between Joe LeDuc and Ron Bass. I mean, that's 2 of the big boys. So how did this TV open up?
Well, Charlie Pratt ran down the loaded TV card, which it really was a loaded card. And Rob and I were wrestling along with the Plowboy Frazier, the Mongolian Stomper. Finally, there was going to be a United States Junior Heavyweight Championship match on the end of this TV show, plus a personality profile with Joe LeDuc and Ron Bass. The TV show is as loaded as the card. And talking about obviously, we're going to be talking about the bull rope match, too.
Okay, so that really was a loaded TV card, so... Set up the first TV match for us. Who was in that?
Well, Rob and I were wearing our Southeastern tag belts to the ring, man, and we were barely announced before the Big C and Randy Rose went to the set with Charlie Platt. And during the course of our match, they're going to be wrestling against Rob and I, and the loser of that match, the losers had to split up as a team forever. So during the course of our match, the Big C, he was out there going crazy with Charlie lodging complaint about the rules that for only him and Randy Rose, second chance, they only wrestled us one time for our belts. Now they're forgetting their second chance, but then they they got this crazy rule that if they lose, they can't wrestle us again. So he demanded to know whose idea that was. And if for just their second title match, why would anybody do that? You know, and he said, so we're wrestling for the Fuller Brothers, the punks, man, their belts. And then he goes, to make losers out of the match, to have to split up as a team forever. He goes, that makes no sense. He goes, how could Don Curtis, the Southeastern commissioner, agree to something like that? And he, I think he said, and this kind of made Charlie Little upset. He said, he says, I think that Don Curtis may be kissing the Fuller Brothers' butts a little bit. No, and Charlie got very upset with that, you know, and Big C used what he had said at the end of that, you know, and so there was still some animosity between Charlie and Big C. It had happened a couple of months earlier over what Big C had to say about Charlie a couple of months before that. So Charlie got right to the point telling the Big C that he and his partner, he said, you guys got just as good a chance to win as the Fullers do, you know? And he says, and if you win, he goes, the Fuller Brothers are not only going to lose the belt, they're never going to be able to wrestle partners again, ever, in Southeastern. And then he says that then you and Randy Rose, he said, you guys will be the tag champions, you know? And then he threw it on the way, he said, and I'd hate to see that. So he finished by saying, the two of you, you know, you're not scheduled to be out here with me at all, you know, and he says, I think it's about time for both of you to leave my set.
I know, Charlie Platt, that sounds just like him. All right, so it really sounds like he kind of went off on him, so on them. So, did they split, they leave?
Yeah, they had no choice, basically. You know, Big C didn't want to. He kind of stammered around for a few seconds or so before he got up and started back for the dressing room. And that was about the time Rob and I, we finished off our opponents. We won the match. Both were Fuller leg locks. And about the time they were headed back to the dressing room, it was a pretty short little interview and a pretty short little match.
Mm. All right. How about the second match? Who was in that?
And it was the giant 6'10", 430-pound plowboy, Frazier.
Wow.
Gosh, he was a monster.
Wow.
And, you know, and his opponent was already in the ring before Plowboy even came out of the dressing room. And for the first time, Plowboy always had this little buddy of his called Floyd. They both wore overalls, you know, and when he came out of the dressing room, he had Floyd with him, but he also had the Big C with him again. So the three of them, there they go to the set. And, you know, Plowboy didn't even go to the ring yet. And he went straight to Charlie, and he started pleading the case for Big C regarding the upcoming tag match where the losing team had to split up forever. And, he was saying, the Big C was a great guy, and, you know, he shouldn't be treated like this, and that he and Floyd had grown very fond of the Big C. And then when the bell rang, they had to ring the bell for the TV match, or I don't think he was even going to the ring. He just continued to talk. And, so he took Floyd with him, and they headed for the ring. Well, the Big C, man, he just worked his way back into the set again, right? And he wanted to get his last word in, I guess, on that subject. So he accused Charlie of having called Don Curtis during the commercial break between the first match and the second match and ratting on him, right? You know, and they had telling him that he didn't like this, the loser team having to split up match. He didn't want to do that. So it was crazy. It was a good little deal going here.
You know, I saw some of the TV shows way back in the day from inside the studio, and I don't know how Charlie could have done that. He never left the set except to prepare for the personality profile, which you kind of had to do that to set up. But so was the Big C trying to get something started again between him and Charlie?
Yeah, I think maybe. I'm pretty sure. You know, Big C, he liked to create pandemonium if he could. Craig Steve was extremely upset by the losing team of Splits Clause in the Southeastern Tag Championship contract, and he and Charlie had definitely not settled. They'd proved right there all the aspects of that problem they had had. So it left Charlie not talking to Big C at all, basically, when that went down for a long time. It was about 2 months before Charlie would even be on the set with the Big C. So Charlie denied having spoke to Don Curtis, you know, but he told Big C, he said, you know, if he didn't leave the set, he said, but if you don't leave my set immediately, he goes, I'm definitely going to call Don Curtis right now. So lucky for the Big C, man, he had a way to avoid the humiliation, being thrown off the set two times in a row. So about that time, Plowboy literally squashed his opponent, man. He does this big splash, 430 pounds on top of a guy, and then he pinned him. And the Big C, when he had to leave the set, he headed right up into the ring, and he shoved old Floyd, who was normally the guy that went in and raised the Plowboy's hand when he won. He shoved Floyd out of the way, and he raised Plowboy's hand. And, you know, I guess Big C was having a bad day so far for this TV.
All right. So there was beginning to be some real heat between Charlie and the Big C in this TV show. All right, so let's go to the personality profile, Stud. Who was on that?
Well, nobody other, none other than the Big C again. And this time he had his bad boy, Texan, Ron Bass, with him. And boy, you could almost feel the tension when the Big C sat down in that personality profile chair by Charlie's chair, right? So, Ron Bass was standing behind him. And so before Charlie said anything, the Big C asked where Ron Bass's bull rope that Charlie had borrowed earlier in the day was. Hours ago, he said, you know, where's Ron Bass's bull rope, you know? So it was obvious Charlie wasn't going to be polite. Spend much time during this profile if he didn't have to, discussing anything with Big C. So Charlie told fans that earlier in the day, he had borrowed the bull rope from Ron Bass, so that Joe LeDuc, which was Ron Bass' upcoming opponent in this bull rope match, could have a look at the bull rope and then say a few words to the fans about it, because Joe LeDuc had never in his life been in a bull rope match before. So, you know, that made sense. Joe LeDuc asked Charlie, he said, hey, you know, can you get me the bull rope so that I can take a look at it? And if I'm going to be in an interview, I want to say something about it. So Charlie called for the director to run the video that was shot earlier in the day. So Joe and Bass had wrestled each other for 3 weeks straight now. This is after Joe had left with these two concussions. He was out for 2 months, didn't get to wrestle at all. And you get a double back-to-back concussions 2 weeks in a row, they keep you out of it. Out of action as long as they literally can. That was about as long as Joe was going to go.
Wow.
It was 2 months. So then when he came back, now he and Bass had wrestled in three matches, three straight weeks. And you know, Ron Bass had given him, you know, the bell that on the bull rope months earlier. You know, Bass hit him twice with that bell. That's how he got the two concussions, is Ron Bass kept bringing that bell to the ring, even though it wasn't a bull rope match, and used it on Joe LeDuc. So since his return, their matches against each other, they had been some pretty bloody matches. I guess that's a good way of putting it. Joe started the interview. He was holding the steel bell that was attached to the rope in his hand, and he reminded fans of what I'd kind of just explained, that 2 months ago, this bell had caused him two concussions. And he said it cost him a lot of pain, and it cost him almost 2 months with no pay. He hadn't been able to wrestle, and you know, and he suffered a dangerous injury, you know, and that since his return, he'd been bleeding every night. But he said, so has Ron Bass, though. We've both been bleeding every night. So and then he pointed to his scarred forehead. He had all these places. Joe had a horrible forehead because he had been busted open so many times. And so he reminded fans, you know, they pointed to his head and he said, this upcoming match, he says, yeah, I guarantee everybody is going to be the bloodiest one yet, you know. And he says, I'm looking forward to it because he says, I'm going to get my revenge, you know. And then, boy, he really scared me and Rob to death with his next line. He said, I'm going to take a blood oath. He couldn't really say oath. He said, I'm going to take a blood oath to make it happen. Wow. This took me back to the axe handle, to the axe when he cut his arm with the axe.
Yeah.
And then, wow. Years earlier. And he took that bell and he smashed it into his forehead. And it opened, cut on his forehead, and blood started running down his face. This was his blood oath. And then he took both ends of the rope and he started swinging it and slamming the bell onto the concrete floor, you know, and time after time. And he was laughing like a madman. It was like, oh, God, Joe. I was like, my gosh, man, you know, crazy. Only Joe could do that type of thing. So fans in the bleachers, you could see them. They were covering their faces and screaming. And, you know, they were not only screaming, but they weren't the only ones screaming because Ron Bass went nuts because he saw what he was doing to his bull rope and the bell on his bull rope. And, you know, so he started demanding, where's my bull rope? I want my bull rope. And so Charlie had stuck the bull rope underneath the chair before they came to the set. And he pulled the bull rope from out from underneath his chair and he handed it to Ron Bass. And the bell was all bent out of shape, you know. So both Bass and Big C started screaming at Charlie, man. And you could tell Charlie, you know, like the studio crowd on the bleachers right next to the profile set, Charlie was pretty scared too, right? He's like, oh, gosh. So Charlie closed the profile right then. He said, that's the end of personality. Probably got up and he left. You know, Bass and Big C were still screaming when they closed the profile out.
Yeah, Charlie kind of had that prerogative. I can stop this when I want to. I can just walk away and it's over. So, listen, I thought maybe this profile was going to be somewhat normal, but, man, was I wrong. This might have been the wildest one yet, Stud. So how do you follow that? What was next?
Well, you know, I guess a great way to follow it was with Bob Armstrong, man. And he came out with the Southeastern belt and he was coming to the set with Charlie and they watched the only video that was in this TV show. The TV show the week before had four videos in it. This one has only one. And it was Bob against the Stomper in the title match. It was a no disqualification match. And they didn't get disqualified, but they didn't have a winner either because they both left the ring. They fought all over the building, man, until the match was finally called a no contest. And so Charlie invited Bob to stay for the next match, and he accepted.
All right. So who was in that match?
Well, the studio fans had just got a little break from this video, this crazy video with Joe LaDuke, and they got a little chance to get themselves a little bit back to normal after all that crazy stuff. And, and the personality profile, you know, it didn't last very long. So,
okay, wait. You're telling me the Mongolian Stomper was next? Come on.
You got it, man.
Had to be.
And then so did the studio crowd. They got it, too. I mean, he went crazier than usual. You watch that Joe LaDuke thing on the video, and he came out of the dressing room running to the bleachers. And he almost emptied the entire studio this time. He got one bleacher full one last time he did this. This time he almost got everybody off both bleachers to leave the ring before finally, Big C could come out and get control of him and get him into the ring. So Bob barely had enough, you know, time to mention his upcoming Texas Death Championship match was on this next card. He was getting a chance to win the belt, and the Stomper was with a championship match with Texas Death. Before, he didn't have much time because the Stomper just went as crazy on his opponent as he did on the crowd there. And wow, there was another short match. I mean, there have been some short matches in this so far. In this
and back to the dressing room he went, I bet. All right. So yeah. That's a great TV show that this is turning into. I guess the last match was the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship match. Am I correct on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's rating period, and so the match of the week for that month was a U.S. Junior Championship match. You had the champion Jerry Stubbs taking on Tony Charles, man, on television. And because of these short TV matches, in the early part of this show, there was quite a bit of time for this match. The match was going to be for TV time remaining in the show. If there was no winner, you know, if time ran out, they would have to ring the bell. But hopefully they were going to have a winner before time ran out. So the other three junior heavyweights in the territory were all at the building that day. And they were all upset because why did Tony Charles get the shot, right? And everybody, these five junior heavyweights, were just competing to get that belt. And so Tony Charles got the shot. Norvell was upset. He came to the set. He sat down, and he couldn't be, but he couldn't be too upset, though, because he was actually going to get to wrestle whoever won this TV match the following week. So, but that didn't stop Ricky Gibson and Sweet Brown Sugar from being upset. And as soon as this match started, both of them came out. They were both in opposite dressing rooms in the TV station. Both of them came out and stood there to watch this match. And the match was absolutely fantastic. Wow. And especially with all three of these junior heavyweights so close to the ring, obviously Stubbs and Tony Charles could see that they're being watched by these other three guys. It was the kind of the match that built your territory. And I mean, it was... As a owner of a territory, this was the kind of thing you wanted to see. The fans went nuts for the entire match. Jerry Stubbs had become a great heel almost overnight, and Tony Charles had always been a fan favorite. No matter where he went, he was always a star. All five of these guys, all five of these Southeastern junior heavyweights were great wrestlers. And as time was running out in the match, you had both Brown Sugar and Ricky Gibson. They ended up at the apron of the ring. I mean, they were almost in the ring. And they were actually cheering on their favorites. You know, and Brown Sugar, he certainly was cheering on the Stubbs. And at the same time, Ricky Gibson's there cheering on Tony Charles. So, everyone in the building was on their feet for probably the last 6 or 7 minutes of that match. And when the time ran out and the bell rang without a winner, but there was a winner, man, and the winner was those people at home and those people in the studio watching, man. They were the real winners.
I tell you what, that had to be one of the best TV shows ever. No, it's no wonder the way you describe how the buildings would fill up in the Coliseums in the Southeast. These TV shows lately have really been great, and I think that's the key to success in filling these buildings. So what happened in the arenas the next week?
Charlie Cook won his match against the Avenger. Cowboy Frazier beat Ted Oates, and he squashed Ted Oates just about as bad as he did the guy on TV. And in the first of the five main events, Ricky Gibson won the three-man match. It was with Tony Charles and Sweet Brown Sugar. And it was going to give Ricky his first United States Junior Heavyweight title match since he had come into the territory. It was a good opportunity for Ricky. And I was glad to see Ricky get into that situation. The next main event was for the United States Junior Heavyweight belt. And that was won by Jerry Stubbs. But it was a great match, a really hard-fought match. He was wrestling against Norville Austin, who was at this point a very popular babyface. He had really changed. Fans really were beginning to get into Norvell. And then in the third main event, Bob Armstrong successfully defended his Southeastern Heavyweight Championship against the Big C. You know, and he did it when the Big C accidentally, Big C got his glove loaded, referee was back turned, and Stomper had a chance. He had Bob held there, and Bob ducked, and guess who Stomper knocked out? Guess who Big C knocked out? He knocked out the Stomper, man. And it was a Texas death match. Stomper couldn't get to his feet at the end of the match. And Bob actually won the match. Then Rob and I won the Southeastern tag match against the Big C and Randy Rose. And those two guys had to split up as tag partners forever. Then in the fifth main event was the wildest match of the night by far. These bull rope matches all were. Joe LeDuc got to the point where he drug Ron Bass around the ring, touched all the four turnbuckles one time, and you had to go do it twice. During the second, trying to get there for the second round, Big C loaded his glove again, and this time he just sneaked in behind the referee, hit him in the back of the head, knocked him out, and then he went after Joe LeDuc. And so the Big C and Bass, then he hit Joe with the loaded glove too, and then Big C and Bass, they took the hand where you, when you got in these bull rope matches, you had a leather strap that strapped you to the rope, to the bull rope.
Yeah.
And they removed that strap from Joe's hand, and they connected him to the one that connected to his hand. Then Bass took the strap off, and they drug Joe over to a ring post. They threw him out on the apron. They put the rope around his throat, and they hung him from the top turnbuckle.
Okay, this might sound crazy. Back then, how was his hand attached? Was it Velcro? How did it work on the rope?
Well, it was a little strap. It was actually made out of leather, and the strap then was connected to the bull rope. The bull rope was braided, so they had a little circle at the end, and the strap went through the circle at the end, and then went around your wrist. So that's how they got that off of his hand. And once they did, then they took it actually off of the Stomper's. I mean, not the Stomper, but Bass's hand.
Right.
And then they hung Joe. They put it around his throat.
Right.
To the top turnbuckle and basically hung him.
Right. Wow.
So luckily, Bob's watching this match, Bob Armstrong. He sees what's going on here. They're going to kill Joe LeDuc. And so he came to the ring, and he threw Big C over the top rope out on the concrete. And then he started, tore into to Bass, and he started using the rope. Then he got Joe untied from the turnbuckle, and then they had the rope, that the old bull rope, but it was Bob had it, and Joe LeDuc had it, and so they hung Bass. Bass's turn.
Wow.
So they did the same thing to Bass. Well, that brought the Stomper to the ring, right? And he managed to get Bass out of, he managed to hit him, caught them both not looking, and he got him from behind. Then he got Bass free from the rope, and he got, went out, got him on the floor where Big C was, and all three of them were able to make it back to the dressing room alive. And, But they failed to get one thing. They failed to get the bull rope. And so now the bull rope was in the hands of Armstrong and LeDuc. And the match was declared a no contest.
Wow, what a night that had to be. All right, so what about the attendances in the three major cities? You had to do well after a TV show like that.
It's just like the week before, man. All three cities sold out and turned people away again, except this time, they turned more people away than ever than they did the last time. So, I mean, the business was just as hot as it could get, basically.
Yeah, I'll say. I mean, to me, it seemed like you need bigger buildings, Ron. So I'm happy to say we do have time today for a Learning Tree question. This one comes from William Plummer. I'm sorry, but he did not tell us his city or state, but he's got a great question. He says, how does a booker know who to bring into a territory to replace a talent that is leaving, and does the present booker make the call to another booker, or does the leaving talent contact the other booker? So how does that dance work out?
That's a great question, Mr. Plummer. You know, well, it's a little confusing almost, but let's tackle it. So let's start with your first question about how does a booker know who to bring into a territory to replace a leaving talent? So the more experienced a booker you had as an owner, the better off you were. And that meant that booker, he knew a heck of a lot of wrestlers, more wrestlers than probably anybody, because he was a booker and it was his job to know who was good and who wasn't. And he knew who he wanted to deal with. And you had more close contacts, he always had other bookers that were close contacts. If he really was worried about somebody or wanted to find out more information, he had to have friends that were bookers, and he could call them and say, hey, tell me about this guy. And so the more successful that a booker was, obviously the more successful were the territory owners. And the booker couldn't be successful if he didn't have connections. So good bookers knew basically who they wanted to fill a vacant spot. I think he asked, when you got a guy leaving, you know, how did you find somebody else? And, you know, he would always look for a guy that he had dealt with him. Somebody he had dealt with before was probably who he wanted to bring in. So the wrestler leaving was sometimes recommended by the present booker to the other booker. So, and if he was a great talent and the other booker knew very little about him, it was kind of okay for a wrestler to make those arrangements with bookers. Wrestlers could talk to bookers, call them up and introduce themselves, you know, and many of them handled their business that way. That's the way they got booked. So I had many future stars, you know, that made their own introductions to me, that called me up and said, hey, Ron, I'm so-and-so, and, you know, I know you don't know me, but, you know, they you got to know guys that way. So I have a good example, man, of what your question is asking here, Mr. Plummer. So it was, and this actually happened in 1979, late 1979 and in early 1980. And this one was a booker swap. Basically, this is kind of what your scenario you had. You got a guy leaving, you got a guy you want to send somebody there, and you want to be able to work this deal out. So I had a great young talent back in 1979, late 1979, named Sylvester Ritter, that literally no one knew anything about, basically. And I was looking to trade him for a top star. So I called my good friend Bill Watts, who was the owner of Mid-South Wrestling, and he was also the booker there at that time. And I talked him into trying out Sylvester. I said, I think this guy will be great for you.
All right. I hate to interrupt, Ron, but I think I know who Sylvester Ritter is or was going to be, but a lot of our listeners may not have heard of him. So who were we talking about?
Okay. So you may have heard of him. I mean, but a lot of people had no idea. So in return for Sylvester, who was going to become basically the biggest star in the history of Mid-South territory, Bill Watts, later on, a couple years later, sent me Crazy Buck Robley, who was a great star for him, who became a star in Southeastern as payment, basically, for sending him Sylvester Ritter, who turned out to be, you know, it turned out to be the junkyard dog, man. And I mean, but, you know, so I'd sent Bill Watts, the guy that turned out to be his very best talent in the history of his territory. And so thanks for your question, Mr. Plummer. I think it's a great question, and I hope I've answered it to your satisfaction.
We talked about McMahon's shenanigans in, I guess you'd say, New York. This is one thing it doesn't seem like he screwed up, was leaving the name Junkyard Dog on Sylvester Ritter. We know he got that right, because that guy went down in history. Well, without a doubt, he was a monster star from Oklahoma to New Orleans, Louisiana. You never know what you're going to hear next in the Studcast. And I think that is what is so cool about this. You bring all of this back to mind, stuff we we thought we remembered, but we've forgotten from years ago. All right, another great one today, Ron, no doubt about it. So where are we going to be riding? Where do we ride in the next Studcast? That was easy for me to say.
All right. We're going to be looking, man, at the next card for the Southeastern Tennessee Territory. We've been going through these each week. We're going to be talking about the next one on a Thursday night, July the 24th, 1980. It's going to be a world championship match again, but this time it's going to be for the heavyweight championship. Harley Race is going to go up against the very popular Tommy Rich, and the special referee is going to be Lou Thesz. And so this may have been the week that the very controversial Tommy Rich win over Harley at the beginning of the week. There was a week back in this time frame, and I think this may be the week in which Tommy Rich beat Harley Race the first night he came into the Georgia Territory for the world title. And the last night before he left the territory, they wrestled again, and Tommy lost the title back to Harley. So I'll have to do a little more research to find out if I'm right about that. But I think that may have happened in this case.
I don't think I ever heard anything about that match. That should be really interesting. And what else for next week? Anything else you can add?
Oh yeah, and not to be outdone, man. Next week, the Gulf Coast card was going to be headlined by two tag matches. One of them going to be the Southeastern Tag Belts. With the Big C, and he's going to have a new partner. Big C is going to have to come back. He can't bring back our boy again, Rose, because they got beat. So he's going to come with a new partner. He's going to come with Plowboy. Plowboy Frazier is going to be partners with Big C.
Wow.
Rob and I for the Southeastern title. And then there's going to be not just one bull rope match next week. They're going to be a double bull rope main event, two bull ropes, Mongolian Stomper connected to Bob Armstrong and Joe LeDuc strapped into Ron Bass.
All right, that's two separate matches?
That's one match, all four guys in the ring with two bull ropes.
Wow, I can definitely see some tangling of ropes in that. Both of those cards sound tremendous. It sounds like fans are going to be blown away again next week. Plus, another TV show, results of matches, and maybe a new learning tree question, hopefully as good as this week, because that was really, really cool. All right, can't wait to get it started. All right, you know the deal. If you want to hook up with Ron, that's easy to do on social media. Find Ron at Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. Like and follow him there. Automatically become friends with a legend. That's on Facebook. Easy to do. Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. On Twitter, also known as X, he is Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow him there as well. Check out the fantastic website at tnstud.com. This Studcast is going to be there, plus every Studcast ever done. Shop the Stud store, where you can get 43 Super Studcasts, four different 8x10 photos, the thrilling Lion novel called Brutus, personally autographed to you, and t-shirts as well, still on sale for only $15.99. That's the Christmas price, y'all, on the last day of July. How about that? All with free shipping. And subscribe to Ron's YouTube channel. It's called Southeastern Rewind. Find hundreds of hours of classic old school wrestling entertainment, 434 total videos, the last 137 Studcasts, 16 Ask the Stud shows, 115 short rides with the Stud. Go back 1 year or more and discover fantastic Stud stories about worldwide stars, 23 Studcast archive stories, 23 Tell Me More fan question shows, Superstars of the Past shows, and so much more. You can sit on the couch for weeks with that. It's YouTube Southeastern Rewind. It's the best deal in wrestling. If you're a wrestling fan, you got to be a part of that. YouTube Southeastern Rewind. All right. Any final comments on this one, Stud?
Well, I hope to see a lot of people in Charlotte this weekend on Saturday. Look forward to that. Please take care of yourselves and others, and may God bless us all.
Well, there's another one in the books for the Studcast. For Ron Fuller in the Great Smoky Mountains, I'm David Summers saying thank you for listening. Find me at davidsummersproductions@gmail.com. This Studcast is a David Summers production for Tennessee Stud, LLC.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the great Smoky Mountains.